Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack.
Welcome to Top Shelf at Merrick Library. I am thrilled to bring you journalist Elon Green for today's episode. Elon Green has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, New York Magazine, and most recently, his work has appeared in The Appeal and Inside Hook. In 2020, Elon Green was anthologized in Sarah Weinman's stunning true crime anthology, Unspeakable Acts. He may also be found at Longform, where he's been an editor since 2011. So that introduction should clue listeners into the fact that today's book, Last Call, and today's guest, Elon Green, mark the first nonfiction author we have hosted on this program. So with that, Elon Green, welcome to Top Shelf at Merrick Library podcast. I cannot thank you enough for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Carol.
Elon, if you would, please tell listeners who may not be familiar what Last Call is about.
It's about the murders of men in the early 90s in Manhattan. They were picked up at piano bars. They were presumed to be gay. And it was about, you know, the murders, but also the subsequent police investigations, and really about the AIDS epidemic happening in the background and the political backdrop, both in the city, but also the country at large.
What I think is particularly interesting is that nobody knew about these murders. I don't remember reading about them. I don't remember hearing about them. What grabs you as a journalist that made you pursue this time period and this case?
It was really the lives of the men. The initial thing that caught my eye were sort of the, you know, prurient, sordid details of the case. But once that hooked me, it was really about the lives of the men and how different they were, and not just generationally, but also just the experiences they've had, some in the closet, some not, where they grew up, their home lives, their professions. They were all so different. And I just started asking myself, how did these guys from their disparate backgrounds end up in these bars at that time? And that sort of became the overarching question that I tried to answer both in my research and in the book.
What is very compelling to the reader is that we know who the victims are before they become victims. You humanize them. You make the reader attached to them. So when I received the galley, I think it was back in November, could have been December, I sped through it in a day and a half. And then I kind of went back to see, especially that first chapter, how you bring the reader in. And like you mentioned, one thing that strikes me and still does today is that I recall the names of the victims. And I still think of, for example, Michael Sakara. I mean, I think about what happened to him. I think about his story, his relationship with his sister, the things that he does for her. At one point, you mentioned that he has this love of African violets. Any reader like me who has African violets in their kitchen, you make him instantly relatable. And I thought, oh my gosh, it's those details that make each one of these victims so personal to us, and how you get them to the point where they run into the killer. So I can remember the killer's name, but I'm more concerned, or I'm more interested in the victims and who they were before they became victims. At one point you mentioned, I think it's in the epilogue maybe, that some of the families say they haven't been contacted by a journalist or the police in, you know, some years. What was that like hearing that for you?
From a purely mercenary perspective, that's exactly what I wanted to hear, because generally, if someone hasn't heard from a journalist in a couple of decades, they're more likely to talk to you because they're not sick of hearing from journalists. You know, and also, quite frankly, not everybody is easy to find. You know, oftentimes, if it's a woman, their names have changed with marriage. And so the fact that I was able to find certain people, I think they thought, well, might as well talk. And yeah, that almost always played in my favor.
Yeah. I almost feel like it's more than just a little bit of kismet that that played in your favor. I feel like, well, the stars aligned there in a positive way.
They really did. I mean, to a great degree, this was a very blessed project. And generally, when things needed to go right, they did. I was very lucky.
It's luck. I think it's without getting too cosmic, I feel like the victims were, you gave them a voice and they were answering you back. It seems like the way everything aligned. So not, I don't want to say easily, but the way all of this went for you, especially when I think about the second victim, which I think is Tom Mulcahy. He's married. His wife was Margaret, and she just keeps like poking at the police. She's just saying, you know, please keep doing this. Please keep pursuing this case. I mean, her part in this is really something else. She stays with it. Can you talk a little bit about Margaret?
Well, I mean, I viewed Margaret from the beginning as a hero, if not the hero of the book, and it was my intention to portray her as such, because I think it's a book with maybe not a lot of heroes. Mm-hmm. And not that every book has to have one, but I think she was. And my initial plan, you know, and it was in the proposal, was to actually have an entire chapter about Margaret and to write about her life and just to sort of see things from her perspective and sort of figure out like why she was so dogged in her pursuit to get this case closed, because just frankly, not everybody was. But she rather understandably chose not to talk to me. Mm. You know, I was reopening old wounds, and I'm sure it would have been just emotionally fairly devastating for her to talk to me, even in best circumstances. So, you know, I ended up having to sort of junk the idea of an entire chapter about her. But I still wanted her as much as possible in the narrative.
And have you heard anything after the book has come out?
I'd be surprised if she ever read the book. I mean, you know, for friends and family of these guys, reading the book is an incredibly painful experience. And quite frankly, I don't know that there's any reason for her to read the book. And I wouldn't advise her to do so.
I mentioned earlier the way you build the case. I kept getting shock after shock. Fred Spencer, and then what happens with Joe Gallagher. I mean, my heart is in my throat. My heart is breaking for all of them. And then there's this sense of anger while you're reading it that you want to have justice served. You want to get to the bottom of this. When you started this book and these layers start unfolding for you as a journalist, are there these holy cow moments for you?
I would say fairly often.
I would think so.
I guess the most notable one is when I got a hold of the transcript of the 1990 bench trial in Staten Island. That was a very lucky thing to get, because generally transcripts for bench trials are not preserved, and doubly so for bench trials where the defendant has been acquitted. And when I read that trial, it was shocking sort of how offensive the proceedings were handled and how just horrible it was that the plaintiff was questioned in such a homophobic manner. I mean, to a great degree, that entire trial is about AIDS. Mm-hmm. And about the dangers of being a gay man in New York in 1989.
I think readers will be captivated by the differences in lots of things, not the least of which you're talking about the trial in Staten Island, but the difference in these investigative techniques of the police force and the forensics that were used. So when I think of the 1970s or the 1980s, I'm thinking incorrectly that we have all these fingerprinting techniques and we have all these methods in place, and things that were employed now were employed back then. But of course, that is absolutely not true. So you mentioned something in the book, the use of the VMD fingerprinting. I was fascinated by that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think vacuum metal deposition had been around since the 70s, but it was not a widely used technique because it was extremely expensive, both the machinery, but also I believe it was expensive because it used gold. But I mean, it also, I think, wasn't widely used because the traditional method of lifting fingerprints, which is the cyanacrylate, is quite effective and is still the gold standard you know, I do think in this particular case, they were very lucky and further fingerprints were lifted with VMD. But I'm not actually sure that those additional fingerprints made the difference in the case. So while it was interesting, and I think it probably was helpful that Canadian law enforcement lifted the additional fingerprints, I don't know that it was decisive.
It's helpful to follow that particular plot line with the first set of fingerprints being taken at the beginning of the book and then watching that progress.
You know, the thing to take away from all this, or at least what I took away from all this, is I was shocked to learn just how sort of useless APHIS is as a database, and that it's only as good as the fingerprints that were put into the system, which meant that it was only as good as the people taking the fingerprints, you know, in any given year, at any given county jail or whatever. And more often than not, they did a really bad job of taking fingerprints.
And so what we know today, we are hopeful. I'm hopeful. Like I said, back in the 70s and the 80s, I'm under the assumption that today things are much better because that's how I need to think.
Well, yes, but only because fingerprints are often taken digitally now. Hmm. But, you know, when you're talking about rolling fingerprints and rolling the fingers, I'd be surprised if people were any better trained now than they were back then. You know, taking actual inked prints is still a real art. It's not an easy thing to do. I mean, you have the variables about needing just the right amount of ink and, you know, moving the fingers in the right direction. It's not as easy as just plopping somebody's fingers down on the paper.
What was the first hook that got set into you to look deeper into the last call?
Oh, well, the New York crimes were the catalyst for my interest in the story. But certainly once I started the research, I was fascinated and horrified by the Fred Spencer case in 1973, just because that had been so poorly documented. You know, the trial transcript hadn't been preserved. The newspaper coverage was kind of haphazard. And of course, that ended up being the case where sort of everything hinged on that. Mm. And of course, because if he had been found guilty in 1973, probably a lot of lives would have been spared. So for me, that became this, you don't want to say that one case is more important than another, but in some sense, that was the most important case because that's where history went one way and it should have gone another.
Right. And I think about it I'm not a journalist, obviously, but I think about your, like a technique. So you find that first case that draws you in, you stick a pin in that, and then you have to go back and then you have to go forward. So let's say you start in 1985 or four. Now you're going back 10 years, 11 years. And then now you have to go forward to see where we are in the 2020s. And that seems so daunting to me. It just seems like it's very hard to figure out what to leave in, what to leave out, how far back do you go? I don't know, as a journalist, how you make those decisions.
Well, it wasn't daunting.
For me, it would be.
if anything, it gave me a sense of freedom to just sort of play with it a little bit. And, you know, the longer time horizon you have, the more material you have, the more stories there are to tell, the more interesting a life is. You know, it's just a fact that the longer somebody lives, the more interesting their life turns out to be. I mean, it's much easier and a richer experience to write about somebody who is middle-aged or older rather than writing about like a teenager. Mm-hmm. So for me, that time horizon was a blessing.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. When I think of all of the investigative journalism options that are out there, and a lot of them now are online, longreads.com, longform.crimereads, etc., Vulture, Texas Monthly. When you were starting out as a writer, was that something you were interested in, the journalism perspective, or was it something, did you ever think about doing fiction, or was this always sort of where you wanted to be?
No, I mean, I just sort of like backed into being a journalist. It wasn't some kind of like lifelong dream. I didn't go to college to study journalism. And when I first got into journalism, I was mostly like writing about politics. Quite frankly, I don't even know how I ended up doing it. I think the first feature I ever wrote was a profile of Maureen Dowd's early years at the New York Times. But as far as, you know, writing about true crime, I still don't do it all that often. It's not something I'm particularly interested in as a genre. I'm just interested in stories and people. And if that happens to be in the true crime space, fine. And if not, fine. You know, we'll see what happens next.
Well, that's a question that's coming up. So you can think about it. In Sarah Weinman's anthology, Unspeakable Acts, she features your work, The Lost Children of Runaway Train, which now I had read Unspeakable Acts in the summer of 2020, I think it was. So I kind of remembered that story, which was an incredible article. And then when your galley pops up for Last Call, I thought, oh my gosh, that's the guy who wrote, et cetera, et cetera. So I picked it up as soon as it came through as a galley that I wanted to read. And I don't think there's a question there, but I do wonder when you interview the families from, like, say, the Lost Children of Runaway Train, and then you interview the friends and the families of the victims in The Last Call, when you do that reporting, it's hard not for me as a reader to feel sympathy and feel the heartbreak and just feel for the families. And I do wonder about that impact for you and how that is. In the epilogue, you talk a bit about this.
Those are by far the hardest interviews to do. I mean, the interview I did for the Runaway Train story, and I talked to the father of, you know, one of the boys who disappeared. And to this day, that's the most difficult interview I've ever had to do. And that was crushing. Usually they're not all that emotionally difficult, but because of their proximity to the victims, it's definitely harder. And, you know, much more sensitive back and forth than it would be otherwise.
When you first submitted the book, was the epilogue your idea? Did that come from an editor? Because it ties up everything.
That was entirely my editor's idea. And in fact, I was against it and I pushed back against it. And I was probably pretty whiny about it. But he was right. And I think it was probably exactly what the book needed, both for reasons of pacing, but also just narrative-wise, I think it kind of wraps things up in a kind of a nice, neat way. And then, of course, with Rick dying a year ago, you know, it ends with more of a emotional punch than it would have otherwise. And so, no, all 100% of the credit for that goes to my editor.
And you can let your editor know, or maybe not, as the case may be. I had a patron come in about 2 weeks ago. We were talking about Last Call, and we were talking a lot about intricacies of it. And then she said to me, oh my gosh, and that epilogue. I said, oh my gosh, I know. And we were sort of, then we start going over. And then, of course, I always keep my reading device handy, and I've opened it right up to some of the things in the epilogue. And can you believe this? And can you believe that? And so just some of those things at the end were really helpful and important from the reader's perspective to know it, the way it ends. It was very illuminative. So I appreciate that. And obviously this other reader did as well. So I'm sure others feel the same. Have you heard that before?
People tend to be really affected by the epilogue, particularly, you know, the conclusion with Rick dying. But I do think people like seeing the author a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, in that space. And because I'm otherwise not in the book at all. And that was a very conscious choice on my part. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I didn't want to write the epilogue, because I was not interested in my part in the story. Because it's not my story. And I don't really think that anything that I went through to write the book is particularly interesting or unusual. But in this instance, I think it worked because it just sort of takes readers into the bar in the present day. And, you know, you get to hear Rick again, and you get to hear patrons and, you know, a back and forth. And, you know, you get to see some of the vitality of the patrons and the flirtatiousness and stuff like that. I think that's a really important thing to see that generation of men in that particular space, which, you know, is vanishing.
Yeah, it is. The perfect way to end the book, like I said, as that patron said, as I certainly feel. When you finished writing the book, was there something you were looking for readers? Because there is no awareness of this. I mean, this woman that I had spoken to, she is in her early 70s, and she had no idea about the serial killer. She had no idea about any of this. What's the takeaway you want for readers for this?
You know, I want readers to have an appreciation of these men's lives, not just the things that set them apart, but also just the banalities of their lives and their day-to-day experiences. And I also want readers to understand just how relentless and pervasive the anti-gay violence was during this period. You know, it was much worse than I suspect than I even knew. And it ran through all areas of society and the legal system and the criminal justice system. And I want that to also be a takeaway. But yeah, I mean, the big thing is I want readers to come away remembering the names of the men who were killed and maybe not remembering the name of the man who killed them.
Yeah. Like I said, this patron could not believe that any of this happened.
But she's not alone.
Right.
You know, all the years and all the time that I worked on the book, I only met a single person who wasn't directly involved in the case, whether as a family member, an investigator, or a friend who had heard of the story. And he knew of it because he was a patron of a lot of those village bars. And he remembers the flyers up on the wall, and it affected his dating life, but that's why he remembers it. He's the only one. And my suspicion is that a lot of people who would remember the case were wiped out by AIDS. But of course, also, as I try to make very clear in the book, there was so much other stuff going on that 4 murders in 3 years was a blip.
That's what's so compelling about the story, this book, and the men involved. It's really just an incredible book, and I really hope that listeners will check it out. And I do want to point readers to your website, because your website is really, it's great. It's a great website. You have a lot of your interviews there and a lot of your long form work there. Recently, or maybe a few months ago, you posted some pictures of Michael on Twitter, which, and then also some pictures of the bar, which was really a gift to see those things. Can readers find you anywhere on social media?
You know, I had tweeted photos of all the victims. There are no photos in the book, and that's for permissions reasons, legal reasons. And they're not going to find those photos elsewhere on any of my social media, although they're available if you search for the names. But as far as finding me, yeah, I'm on Twitter, and I'm not on Facebook. I am on Instagram, but it's a locked account. You know, my email address is on my website. So yeah, I'm not that hard to find.
I'm saying this because I think if readers are interested in looking at some of these other journalism pieces, I think that it's worth going there to take a look at. And I believe the website is elongreen.com.
That's correct.
So readers can find you there. And before I do let you go, is there anything you would like to share with listeners, some titles or some article recommendations or things you would recommend to readers?
I think if readers have not read Sarah Weinman's book, The Real Alita, they should, because it is one of the great feats of archival research.
That is an amazing book. I read everything she writes, so I will put the link to that and to some of her other things in the podcast page for this episode. And again, readers and listeners, today's book is called Last Call, A True Story of Love, Lust, and Murder in Queer New York by today's guest, Elon Green. Elon Green, thank you so very much for joining us. I'm really, really appreciative that you gave me the opportunity to ask all of my questions, and I haven't even scratched the surface, but the questions that I had today, I'm very grateful.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us on Top Shelf. And listeners, also thank you for joining us today. Remember to follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library on Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and wherever you find most podcasts for the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library. Check out our website at merricklibrary.org. Special thanks to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Diane Bondi, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and on to the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.